Alright, this is going to be part three on my death of self reflections. I figure since I already did part one and two, I might as well knock out the rest of it while it's all kind of stirred up and fresh in my mind. And I don't know if people, like, want to hear me talk about this. I hope I'm not giving off the impression that I'm trying to tell a sob story or elicit sympathy. That isn't my intentions at all. And I'll be honest, like, I don't like talking about these experiences for a number of reasons. Like, one, it's hard for people to relate to these experiences. And two, I don't generally like to draw attention to myself. And three, you know, some of the things that I've been through, like, while they were pretty extreme and unusual, I haven't been through that much more than plenty of other people have. You know, just we all have different experiences and we all walk different paths in life. We all have a story, and this one is mine. So I guess on the back end of the SEAL training thing and finding myself in this place of just complete ego death, like, that's when I first heard that term, it totally nails the way that I felt at that point in time, like a total loss of sense of self. Everything that I thought I was, everything that I thought I knew about myself, all the lies that I told myself, that I had convinced myself were true and internalized in my entire life, kind of melted away over, you know, the course of that year that I was broken down mentally and physically, you know, for the purposes of trying to become a SEAL. And that's kind of a big part of the program. I have a very distinct memory of early on in my training curriculum being in the pool and swimming facing the wrong direction or something like that. Something very inconsequential that in any other environment wouldn't be a big deal, but in a hyper stressful environment like that, where you're under a microscope 24/7, doing something like facing the wrong direction when everyone else is facing a different direction is like a death sentence, man. Like, you're gonna get pulled out and singled out and picked apart, and that's what happened, right? And that's not unique. Like, that's just kind of part of the deal, right? That's not like them picking on you because they don't like you or like singling you out for any reason other than, you know, you're not doing what you're supposed to do, and in that line of work, it gets people killed. So I got pulled out of the pool because I was facing the wrong direction, because at this point in time, I was still incredibly uncomfortable in the water and just nervous and tired and whatever. So they pull me out of the pool, and they've got me bear crawling around the pool, which is horribly exhausting, especially when you just finished doing, like, you know, sprints in the water. And I'm going very slow because I'm just tired and worn out and stressed. And the instructor calls me over and says, "Hey, you, bear crawl over here." So I bear crawl over to him, and he starts giving me some personalized extra special attention, making me do these things called star jumpers, which are horrible. You can only do, like, when you're already gassed and your body's already, like, filled with, I guess, lactic acid is what people call it, but the burning is sensation that you get from prolonged exercise without recovery is actually a buildup of hydrogen ions. That's sort of a byproduct of the lactic acid. It's not the lactic acid itself, it's the hydrogen ions that makes your blood more acidic. So I'm like, I'm burning and I'm just dying doing these star jumpers. I think I did like five before I got to failure, and he was just letting me have it, man. Just letting me know that, like, my performance was totally unacceptable. Like, I didn't belong there. And then he had me on the ground doing, like, flutter kicks or something like that. And he had me And I don't know if this is intentional. I don't think it was. But he had me in this pool of water that was dripping down off the ceiling. It was like this rust water that was dripping out of like an AC vent or something like that from the ceiling. And the ceiling was very high up. But it was just like a small spot of brown water on the ground. And I will never forget this. My pants had like this brown rust water all over it. My shorts that I was wearing. And it was all over like my stomach and my back because I had been all over the ground. The instructor looked at me and pulled me up and made me stand at attention and was like, "You just shit all over my pool deck, didn't you?" And of course, at this point, you know, like I'm embarrassed. I'm tired, like I'm exhausted, I'm stressed, and I'm just like, no, I didn't, it's like water from the ceiling or something, like, I don't know what it is, I don't know what's going on, and he's like, "I can't believe you just shit all over my pool deck," so he's like making me run and go real quick, like change my clothes. It's just something that they do to like stress you out, is like make you change your clothes when you're soaking wet into like something dry and give you like 2 minutes or whatever. It's almost always impossible to meet the timeline because you're soaking wet, like, you know, when you try to put on socks when you just get out of the shower, it's like that, you know, but like magnify that by 100 times and with stress and timelines and everything. So I'm like going, I hurry up and change and I come back, and then he makes me like go and get a mop bucket, and like he's telling all of my peers in the class that I shit on the pool deck and that now I'm having to mop it up as my punishment. And then his demeanor totally changed. And he got really calm, and he pulled me aside and took me into another room. And his face softened up and his voice softened up, like his demeanor was totally different. And he said, "Hey man, what are you doing here? Like, you don't belong here. You and I both know, like, you're never gonna make it through this training." Keep in mind, this was like the first or second week that I was in the Navy that this was happening. And this guy was a Navy SEAL, by the way. He was just doing his job, putting me under mental stress and attempting to weed me out from the very beginning. And he's like, "Hey, man, what are you doing here? Like, you don't belong here." He said, "You know, I know you. Like, I see right through you. You put up this big show. You wake up every morning and you look in the mirror and you hate what you see. And for some reason, like, I don't know what it was, if it was like the stress of the situation and like, you know, your whole life changes when you join the military and it changes very fast. And just like the combination of like the stress that he had put on me and the embarrassment that he had put me under, you know, accusing me of shitting my pants on the pool deck. And now, you know, totally changing his demeanor and making it seem like he could just see right through me. Like I was totally transparent and he could see my deepest, darkest secrets, broke me, man. Like I started to cry, like right there. Here I was like in this training program to be like an elite special forces operator. And I, you know, signed up and joined the military and I'm here like on the other side of the world and like I'm getting my ass kicked on a pool deck. And this grown man is making another grown man cry, like literally weep. Because of what he was saying to me, because I felt like he could see right through me, and I felt like he could see the parts of me that I kept hidden from people. And of course, like, I didn't let him talk me into quitting. He was like, "Come on, man, like, I'll help you out, like, we'll go get you a good job, like, I'll look out for you, I'll make sure that you're taken care of, just come, just say the word, come with me, we can end all this right now." Of course, I told him that, like, I didn't want any part of that, like, I was here for one reason, and he wasn't gonna stop me. It wasn't until years or months later or something like that, I learned through a guy, I guess, whose dad was a SEAL, who told him that part of the training that those instructors go through in weeding people out of the program is to take whatever their internal struggles were when they were going through training and project them onto the individuals that they're training. So essentially, and this is just like my best guess at what was going on there, he had kind of cold read me a little bit and basically taken, you know, could tell that like he was starting to get to me, get under my skin, and then took what he saw in himself, what he remembered that he struggled with that he learned from himself during, you know, like that ego death and breakdown process, when he was going through training, and just projected it onto me. And that type of like cold reading and loose association and generalization of people, like, especially when they're under stress and they're not thinking clearly, can make it seem like you can almost read a person's mind. But it's really just a psychological manipulation technique, and it's very effective. But that I tell that story to kind of just give you a glimpse into the type of, like, the nature of that training. Like, because I can't tell you, you know, what it was like in its totality. And yeah, you can look up videos and see the videos of people carrying around the telephone poles and running with the boats on their head and swimming in the ocean and all that stuff. But it will never give you an accurate picture of the mental stress and the emotional stress that you're put under in those conditions, in those physically stressful conditions that are designed to just break you and test you and push you constantly. So I tell that story to kind of give an example of just how mentally and physically broken down I was after, you know, going through this kind of treatment for like 9 months or whatever it was. And on the tail end of that, I can remember laying in my bed, and I wasn't married with my wife at this point. We were kind of like texting each other, but we weren't even really dating. And I remember texting her and telling her that I was going to marry her, and she told me that I was crazy. And I think like 2 months later we were married, because it's like I said, that's just the kind of person I am. When I make up my mind about something and I set my goals on something, that's all there is. There is no like plan B, there is no like easing into it. It's 100 miles an hour or nothing. And I can remember laying in bed shortly after I was dropped from the program and just crying, you know, because I was just so broken. Like, I didn't know who I was anymore. My future felt so uncertain. I felt like I was both closer to and further away from God than ever before. I think it was Paul who said that Christ or God said to him, you know, Paul, my grace is sufficient enough for you in these moments of suffering, because my power is made perfect in weakness. And again, you know, you don't have to be religious. I'm telling you that I experienced that. I felt that. I know that. And in that moment, I can remember begging God, like, God, okay, I understand, like, for whatever reason you're putting me through this horribly painful experience that's designed to shape me. Like, and I shared the story that that guy Matt told me, you know, the prophetic vision that he had of the tree being flooded and washed all the dirt away, and the only thing left was the roots clinging to truth. And I can remember, you know, I couldn't have put that into those words at the time, but I remember having a sense of awareness that this was all happening for a reason. And I remember just begging God, like, okay, it's like, God, I understand, like, you have to put me through this. Just please, please, please don't let me lose this girl. You know, like, I will lose everything. I will lose everything about myself. I'll start that over, but please just don't let me lose my wife. Like, I know you put her in my, you know, at the time she wasn't my wife. And like I said, we were married, I think, 2 or 3 months after that, if that. It was not very long. I had convinced her to come fly out to where I was, and we got married in a courthouse. No wedding or anything like that. It was excellent. Actually, I got married in the same town that my parents got married in, by total coincidence. Like, total random coincidence. It just so happened that that's where I was. So it was pretty wild. So obviously, when you get married, it happens more so when you have kids, but when you get married, it forces you to readjust, or at least if you're an honest man, it forces you to readjust your priorities in life. You know, the things that were once important to you become less important. And to go through such a dramatic shift, you know, in priorities, in focus in life, during a time of such great reinvention of self, I think was good, you know, because it gave me perspective, and it forced me to admit that the reason, you know, that I was crying on that pool deck a year before I got to this point where I had finally married my wife, which, remember, was a part of the motivation that I had for joining the SEALs in the first place, was because I wanted to be able to attract women with my swagger and with my status. And I had, at the very least, you know, despite my failure, achieved a lot of what I had wanted. You know, I got access to some training. I pushed myself like I wanted to push myself. Like, I have no regrets. Like, I know in my heart that I gave that training everything I had. Like, I left everything I had in that training program. I discovered limits that I didn't know I could pass, you know, in every aspect of myself. So I realized that that reason that I was sitting there crying on that pool deck was because, even though that guy may have been like cold reading me and projecting onto me, I believe what he was saying about me was mostly true. I didn't really like myself, and I had convinced myself that I was much greater than I was. And I was afraid of people finding that out about me, you know, deep down. Despite the fact that I talked about that first ego death that I had when I was much younger, I still had this deep-rooted insecurity about who I was, and not just who I was, but whether or not other people accepted me. And whether, you know, the whole fear of being vulnerable with people, and the fear of whether or not they'd like me for who I was, and that forced me to put up walls, and not just walls, but projections of who I wanted to be, because I much rather have had people see me for who I wanted to be than for who I actually was. And I think that this is not unique to me. I think that this is humanity laid bare. I'm certain that I'm not the only man who's ever struggled with such things. It's just incredibly difficult to see it, because in order to see it, your ego has to die, right? You have to be able to transcend being so caught up in yourself that you see that you're not that different from everyone else. So it was in this revelation, and it, you know, this, keep in mind, like, none of this happened overnight. We're talking about years of self-development and reflection and late nights of bad dreams and not sleeping and whatever to sort through all this. I realized, you know, I don't really have any skills. I'm intelligent, but I don't really know anything. Like, I'm smart, I'm capable, but I've never really applied myself to learning anything useful outside of committing myself, you know, to becoming a pretty decent boxer and wrestler, and learning about how the human body works and how I could maximize, you know, sets and reps and distance running and swimming and whatever to be in as good a shape as I can. But while that's useful to some degree, I didn't have any intentions of ever using that knowledge for employment. I didn't have a plan for how I could use those skills to provide for a family. I certainly didn't have any concept of how those skills are particularly valuable to society. And as you know, as we know, that's how you make a living in the world, is by providing value to others. And when they value what you provide, they're willing to pay you for it. And if you're good at what you do, they'll pay you a lot. I had no desire to work as a strength and conditioning coach, or to go on to practice clinical medicine and do something like physical therapy. That just wasn't really in my wheelhouse of things that I was aspiring to do. So I had this revelation, you know, it was like, I don't have any skills. You know, I worked for a moving company for 4 years while I was in college, just because it helped keep me in shape, and I liked the challenge. But that wasn't going to be what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, to pay the bills. I had no concept of how the world really worked, right? There were all, like, so many things that were just an enigma to me, like politics. I heard people talk about politics. I was one of those types of people who read the news and pretended like I understood things without any real comprehension. I had no understanding of money or finance or how to invest. I pretended like I did. I put on like this outward appearance that, oh, I know everything about everything, because I was too afraid to admit to myself that I wasn't as perfect as I thought I was. So in began the long, arduous process of, you know, self-admission that I had a lot to learn and that I had nothing to offer the world. And unfortunately for me, I wasn't in a position where I had a job in the Navy that was going to be teaching me a technical skill that would have application in any way, shape, or form outside of the military. I was very unfortunate in that regard. Maybe it was to my blessing. Maybe years from now I'll look back and say, well, if I hadn't been in the situation I was, I wouldn't have pursued my own education and development as fiercely if I had been in a position where I was learning like a technical skill that I could have fallen back on once I finished my time in the military. It might have changed things. So, you know, maybe all these things do happen for a reason, but it started with around the time that I think it was around the time Donald Trump got elected. I remember there was just a sweeping political fervor in America, and I remember kind of being captivated by it a little bit. In some ways, by the rhetoric of the Trump campaign, but in more ways, the ways in which politics seems to sweep through people like a fervor. Like I said, I can't imagine that I had really much concept of what was happening and a lot of the things that were being discussed and the names that were being said. And people often, you know, you see people in YouTube comments and Twitter comments talk about names and events and history and places and all of these types of things, and they use it to justify certain things, and you read those and you think, wow, yeah, okay, that makes sense. But very rarely, at least this is how I was, very rarely would I have any ability to verify what they were saying or whether or not their application of linguistics and theory was accurate. And I finally could recognize that about myself. I could finally recognize that there was so much I did not know. And I remember thinking back to a friend I had in college that I only knew when I was a freshman because I trained jiu-jitsu with him. And I believe he was a senior. So him and I didn't really interact at all after my freshman year because I'm sure he moved on to other things. But I remember being especially impressed by him because he was very kind. He was very humble. He was incredibly strong and athletic. And that were the types of things that I respected in people. And he was very, 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 very smart. Like, smart as a whip, this guy. And it's a one-off thing. It's totally random. But I remember this guy randomly coming into my mind. And I thought back to him and how his profile picture on Facebook was him shaking hands with Ron Paul. And I remember thinking, well, shoot, you know, that guy was really smart, like one of the smartest, most self-actualized people that I can remember. And if he liked Ron Paul, and I see all these other idiots, and they either pick left team, red, left team, right team, red team, blue team, and they can't even really articulate very well in ways that are convincing and satisfying to me, why? Maybe I should learn more about this Ron Paul guy. So I did, actually. I bought Ron Paul's book off of Amazon, and it was called End the Fed. And I didn't, from what I remember, I think I was on Amazon because I was buying Donald Trump's book, Make America Great Again, or Great Again, or something like that. And Amazon just so happened to suggest a book to me after I added Trump's book to my cart. And really, the reason I was wanting to read Donald Trump's book was just to get a better understanding of, like, political theory. Like, who is this guy? What does he believe? Why are people so riled up about him? Do I believe what he believes? And asking myself, like, those types of honest questions. Like, I want to hear from him. What does he think? What are his proposals to fix what, you know, I had identified early on in my life are the multitudes of problems that we have. And it just so happened that Amazon recommended Ron Paul's book and the Fed to me, and I remember thinking, hey, that kid I knew in college, he liked Ron Paul. I'm going to check out Ron Paul's book too. So I added it to the cart, and I bought it, and I read it, And I remember being incredibly disturbed because I, up until that point, didn't really know anything about the Fed or about how money worked. I told this story when I gave my presentation in Miami at the Bitcoin conference, but I was fortunate enough to have a pretty big collection of fiat monies from all over the world ever since the time I was a little kid, because my dad traveled a lot and he would always bring me money from different countries, and I have it all in a collection. And I used to sit and look at it for hours because it just fascinated me. But it wasn't until this point in my life that I was finally ready to ask the question, what even is money? And I remember posting on Facebook about this book that I had just read that totally blew my mind and changed the way that I looked at the whole world. And a friend that I had went to Buds with recommended that I read a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island. Well, you can probably imagine that from here, you know, the rest is history. Once you get started on this path, if you're intellectually curious and honest at all, there's really no stopping where you go next. And I believe it was from the footnotes of and the Fed and from the footnotes of The Creature from Jekyll Island that I found and began to explore Austrian economics. And I can remember very distinctly reading F.A. Hayek's The Road to Serfdom in the middle of the night on a gunship in the Arabian Gulf underneath the red lights, which are the lights that they turn on at night so that it doesn't affect your night vision. And I remember sitting there on watch reading Ron Paul's Road to Serfdom, and so many things for me began to click. History began to make sense. Money began to make sense. Finance began to make sense. Politics began to make sense. And it wasn't like all of a sudden a light switch flipped in my head and I understood everything and I knew everything. It was that all of a sudden a light switch flipped in my head that allowed me to reorient myself towards truth, that gave me a lens through which to view the world where I could now make amends with all of these things that just didn't sit right with me, that I couldn't explain, that I couldn't put my finger on. These things that drove me to try to find an escape hatch or satisfaction or a purpose elsewhere in life, you know, and drove me to go try to pledge my life and blood to the U.S. government. To try and save the world from this thing I couldn't even define. I began to have clarity. I found clarity on these things, and I devoured Austrian economics texts. And it was at this point that I, through happenstance, started to get involved in cryptocurrencies. And it was because at the time, like I said, I didn't know anything about finance, and being at the point where I was starting a family and starting to make a little bit more money and getting to the point where I had disposable income and I had to figure out what to do with it, I had started investing a little bit and buying stocks with a brokerage account. And then I was like, oh, well, what about these penny stock things? These are really interesting. And I started learning about those. And if you want to be successful trading penny stocks, you have to really, really dig deep on market fundamentals and learning how to read filings, and learning about like what pump and dumps are, and learning about the equity share structure of a company. And you really kind of have to give yourself a crash course if you want to be at all successful in trading those types of equities. And I did, actually. I was pretty good at it, but I realized pretty quickly that it wasn't something that I wanted to do, just because it wasn't really for me. And I was quickly finding myself way more interested in cryptocurrencies, because this was around 2017, when the price was moving pretty parabolically in a lot of these tokens. And ultimately, that's what led me to Bitcoin, was this process of self-discovery, finding Austrian economics, you know, trying to get involved in trading equities, and then sort of just finding myself coincidentally in this world of cryptocurrencies. And I got a little lost there along the way, where I bought into these narratives of blockchain everything and decentralize the world. And all of that made total sense to me because I had such a poor grasp of the implementations of computer science. And then it was when I met J.W. Weatherman, which, you know, you guys make up your own opinions about him. I'm not here to try to convince you that he's a good guy or a bad guy. I'm just telling you my story. I came across his YouTube channel in 2017, and he really stuck out to me because he was somebody that spoke with a great amount of clarity on a great number of topics. And I remember reaching out to him and talking to him a little bit in private messages, asking him questions, just discussing topics. And he invited me to attend this course that he was doing, that I forget what he was charging for it at the time, but it was essentially a course, like a crash course in like economics and Bitcoin. And I was like, you know, what the hell? Like, I'm spending money on education in lots of different ways right now, like to better myself. This guy seems really well put together, and I'd like to, if nothing else, pay him for some of his time, for the opportunity to like pick his brain and not feel like I'm just wasting his time. So I did, and I took his course, and that course is what became part of that course is what we sort of reinvented into 10 hours of Bitcoin a couple years later, or a year later, or whatever it was, which is now free, and you can find it at 10hoursofbitcoin.com. But that kicked off a relationship that I had with him, and he convinced me to begin pursuing technical and professional development as a computer programmer. And that totally changed my world because it gave me a much better understanding. And I've been working on this for years, right? This was not a one and done thing. I started with Justin Moon's Biddle Bootcamp, which is what he used to call it. Now I think it's Mooniversity, after taking like some basic Python classes. And then I kind of got stuck with that, and that fizzled out. And then like over time, I'd do a little bit of like a little bit more Python. Like I'd write a script or something silly. And as my understandings of computer science and just working with code and working with computers developed, I began to sort of dismantle this narrative around cryptocurrency as a whole. And I think a lot of Bitcoin Twitter, or like the Bitcoin community, or whatever you want to call it, kind of converged on a lot of these revelations all at once. There was like this great synchronicity where we were all kind of like, yeah, no, like it's Bitcoin, not shitcoins. And I understand that there were a lot of people who maybe figured this out earlier. You know, I greatly respect those people and their intellect and their ability to self-reason. I wasn't one of them. And it took me engaging with a lot of really smart people who challenged my assumptions to get to the point where I was ready to say that, like, yes, Bitcoin is the killer app. Bitcoin is the technology that revolutionizes so many of these problems with society and government. The rest is history, guys. I mean, I started the podcast. Well, so before that, I got involved with a cryptocurrency YouTube network called Decentralized TV, and I floundered there a little bit, but I pushed through it and kind of developed myself, my ability to communicate, you know, on camera and on audio. That's a skill that I developed to which I'm eternally grateful to my friend Peter Saddington for helping me develop. That was a great thing for me because that sort of directed me towards starting my own podcast, which you're listening to right now. It was a Bitcoin Echo Chamber. And my only goal with the Bitcoin Echo Chamber was to have conversations with people who I wanted to learn from. And that was why I called it the Bitcoin Echo Chamber, was because I didn't have any interest in having debates with people whose opinions and takes I didn't respect, or which were based on different fundamental assumptions. You know, it was from like listening to guys like Pierre and Bitstein on Noted, and reading books from someone like Saifedean, and talking to someone like J.W. Weatherman, that I was really intellectually challenging my assumptions, and discovering, you know, truths that were self-evident and axiomatic and could actually have application, and have since made me, you know, a much more successful, much more developed person with the ability to parse current events, I feel like, with an astounding amount of clarity. And, you know, say whatever you want about J.W. Weatherman, but he's been a tremendous friend to me, and I can't thank him enough for how much he's helped me with my personal growth. And that's really what the podcast was having guys like him on and just having conversations, hopefully, you know, letting that develop even more discussion, and people would reach out. I would encourage people regularly to reach out to me if they liked what I had to say, or if they had questions or comments on the things we were discussing. And that's even how I met Ben Prentice. You know, he reached out to me through this process of like self-discovery and growth and creating content the types of stuff that, that I was really passionate about. That was what I wanted to create content on. And I knew I never wanted to do it full time. It was never supposed to be a job. I still, to this day, I don't want to be a content creator full time because I don't like being beholden to advertisers. I don't like putting out content on centralized platforms. I don't even really like the idea of being like an entertainer slash journalist. Like, it doesn't appeal to me. I want to write code. I want to build businesses. I want to solve problems. I like doing this as a hobby. You know, maybe, and I'm not saying it'll never happen, but I just don't see it ever becoming a job, and I've never wanted to treat it like a job, and it's why I don't upload podcasts every week or whatever, and why I don't always get on the latest and greatest guests is because I have no desire to make it a vocation. So currently I'm in Lambda school, and I'm kind of glossing over and fast-forwarding a little bit here, but I have to, right? Because I'm talking about experiences that took place over a decade, and then Bitcoin, which has been the last half decade, and I think a lot of like the more recent events, like if you follow me on Twitter and you keep up with some of the speeches that I've done and podcast interviews that I've done, like you kind of have a pretty good understanding of where I'm at now and what I've sort of developed my worldview and my ways of thinking into, and where I draw inspiration and which sources I've used. You know, I wrote Fiat Lux, which was an article that was published in Bitcoin Magazine. And I feel like that's, in a lot of ways, the magnum opus of the economic theory that I've sort of put together on how we got to where we are. You know, and obviously WTF happened in 1971 was a huge hit. And I never would have imagined that a little bit of creative energy and a whole lot of late night nerd sessions with Ben would have turned into a cultural phenomenon, which I really feel like, you know, it's a niche cultural phenomenon, but it's a cultural phenomenon nonetheless. I mean, Edward Snowden and Jack Dorsey tweeted it. You know, we were trending on Twitter. The lifetime views of the site are over 2 million at this point, I believe. It's been unbelievable. I can't believe it. And it really just speaks to how important it is to value truth, to seek truth, to be intellectually honest, and to, you know, and again, I don't have any advice for people who want to try to emulate my path and want to try to do what I did and experience that death of self so that they can have the clarity, you know, to really cut through all the BS that they've put up around themselves for everyone else and really get down to brass tacks and ask themselves the right questions and admit that they know nothing and start at the beginning, right? Because if all you've ever done is accept 99% of what you learned in public school, you're floundering right now. You have no idea what's going on in the world, and you're confused and you're scared, and you're just hoping that the government saves you. So that's my story. I'm sure that there were parts that I wish I would have said better or glossed over that I wish I hadn't, or details that I hadn't expounded upon that would provide greater context in certain things. But I did my best. You know, this was all unscripted. I basically did this in three uncut takes. So hopefully you guys enjoyed listening to this little piece of story about my life. And I'm not out of the woods yet, guys. Like, I'll be honest. Like, at this point, the cat's kind of out of the bag, right? Like, I've kind of told enough to probably soft dox myself. But I'm probably going to get kicked out of the military here soon for non-compliance with this whole vaccine thing, and that's okay. Like, you know, I think that might actually be the best thing that could happen to me right now, because I'm still stuck in this position of indentured servitude. And again, once I'm out, out from under the auspices of the Department of Defense, I intend to do a retrospective with Rulla McFlugel on his podcast to talk about the fascism and the culture. Like I said earlier, I have a lot of thoughts and a lot of grievances to air in that regard. But I hope you guys enjoyed listening to this retrospective. Again, this is me humbly coming before you and just telling you my story. And I don't really know, you know, what my expectations are for any of you who listen to this. But just that I thank you for listening. And I hope that you got something out of it and you can find ways to apply it to your own journey in life. And then I hope that you continue to seek truth and I hope that you continue to find honesty, you know, in yourself and in the way that you look at things. And That's all I got, guys. I'll see you.